So my name is Gabriel and I'm an alcoholic. Today's date is 12/17/22. We are at the MSCA OA. The interview is being given to or by myself, Gabriel, and I'm interviewing Dick J. And let's see. This tape is produced for the Mid-Southern California Area Archives and as such will not be reproduced for other uses. This tape will remain in the custody of the Mid-Southern California Area Archives. Do I have your permission to tape this interview?
Yes, you do.
Awesome. So again, my name is Gabriel and I'm an alcoholic and my sobriety date is 11/19/20. So Dick, we'll get right into it. How did you first make contact with AA?
Well, my name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is January 1st of 71, and AA made contact with me. I was stationed in Naples, Italy. I was 23 years old, and about a year before I got sober, there was a fellow that was transferred into my detachment who got sober in Yokosuka, Japan, and he brought AA with him, and about 9 months before I got sober, the 20 questions started ending up on my desk. 20 questions about, are you an alcoholic? And I would lie like heck, and I answered only 11 yes. And I said, and it says on the thing about if you answer three or more, you're definitely an alcoholic. And I said, gee, isn't that nice? I can drink like an alcoholic and not be one. But he kept in contact with me. He was kind. He was low key. And about a week or so before I got sober, I was involved with a married woman, and she decided to stay with her husband. And he knew I was getting close to my bottom. He knew that I'd been up to the hospital, and they wondered why a 22-year-old at the time had a fatty liver. He knew that he'd seen me drink at parties. And he said, when you are ready, give me a call, and I will listen to you. And January 1st of 71, I was at a party. I was blind drunk. I had just gotten off of work, and I had to be working 8 hours. And a friend of mine was upset, and he says, you know why this lady left you is because you're a drunk and her husband could take away their son. And the rage in me that had been building blew up. And he'd never seen that rage. Alcohol usually kept the rage down, didn't work. And so he said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to kill the husband. And he was across town, and he was holding on to my arm, and like this, and he was holding on, and I said, let go, and he didn't, and I went like this, and he hit the ground twice before he put his head into a plate glass door with steel bars in it, and he jammed it open, and when he hit the ground, I thought he was dead, and I asked an honest question. First honest question I'd asked in a long time, and that was, why would a nice guy like me in quotes do something like this? And what I was given was a gift. I was given a gift in my mind's eye of seeing every single resentment I ever had. And each one of these resentments, the miracle was this, it didn't come from my head, because I could see that each person I was resentful at was just trying to live life, and I was the one that demanded life revolve around me and my drinking. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. My God, it's not them, it's me. And about that time, they took my friend up to the hospital. He needed some stitches in his hand, and he had a mild concussion. And an acquaintance said, Dick, you're just a little bit upset. Why don't you come back up to the party and cool off and have a drink and cool off? And I don't know who was more shocked, him or me, when I said, no, I can never drink safely again. And that was on January 1st of 71. And that night I got ready for work, and I had to be back at work at 7 o'clock. There was no phone. So I went to the office to sleep it off. And I called this guy It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and the first words out of his mouth is, "I've been expecting your call." And so he says, I told him I was still drunk. And he says, "Dick," he says, "why don't you get after work, get some rest, and come over and we'll talk." And so I said, "Okay." Well, I was able to get a little bit of sleep there in the office, and then took over the duties. And that morning, the alcoholic thinking started to take over. And I talked to my friend. He was okay. He didn't press the charges. I went to the building supervisor. I paid for the door. And in the afternoon, I started feeling good again. And then my hand was on the doorknob of the last phone between me and my friend. And because I was thinking, oh, maybe I overacted last night, saying I'd call him. And my hand wouldn't leave the doorknob. And I walked in and I called him. And he says, "Dick," he said, "last night you were drunk out of your mind. That took no guts. This took guts. Get some rest and come over and talk to me." And the second miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened that night when I was able to listen to another human being talk for 2.5 hours without me saying, yeah, but I'm different. Yeah, but you don't understand. And I listened to him. And he held up two books. One was Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other was Neurotics Anonymous. And he says, "Dick, you're fully qualified for both programs. Which one do you want?" And I said, "Well, I don't want to act like I'm crazy. I'll go with Alcoholics Anonymous." He says, "Good. There's a meeting tomorrow night." And then at my first meeting, at the end of the meeting, I had my cleanest, dirty shirt on. And they let me drink my coffee through a straw because I was shaking so bad I couldn't even hold still. And at the end of the meeting, they asked me this question. And they didn't preach. All they just said, the six people there at the meeting, and they just shared their stories. And after the meeting, they said, "Dick, which drink gets you drunk?" And I was trying to be honest, and I says, "The fifth." It was the fifth. And they says, "Dick, if you don't take the first, you won't get to the fifth." And that made sense to me. And then they had the audacity to give me my first AA commitment, cleaning the ashtrays. And as I was cleaning these ashtrays, I saw myself doing it, and I started to cry and I started to bawl because I saw myself doing something that I thought I had lost the ability to do. I didn't think I could give to others. And service work to this day has been so beautifully said by other speakers, has been so important to my sobriety about giving it away. And there was six of us in Naples, Italy at the time. And we only had two meetings a week. There was another group in Rome, but that was the only groups that were in the country. And but we got together a lot of houses. And what I loved was I was just part of the group. I was a young kid. They were all in their 40s. But they knew that with my I didn't know him as a sponsor, but my friend, when they'd look at me funny, he'd go, "Oh, yeah, he belongs here. Yes, he definitely belongs here." And that was my start. And when I transferred, I went through New York City and I got to my first young people's meeting, and my mouth just dropped that yes, I did belong. I was a part of. And so that was a 50-cent answer to a nickel question.
That was beautiful. You covered a lot of the questions I had, but you did mention sponsor. Did you have a sponsor like early on, or how did you go about getting?
Well, when I got to the States, I was transferred to Northern California, close to where Harry was at, and I was in Napa, California. And about 3 weeks into the meetings, this fella comes up to me and says, "My name's Napa Joe, and I'm going to be your sponsor, and you need me desperately." And he became my sponsor, and he took me to a lot of places. He took me to a lot of 12-step calls. And he took me to our first convention in Fresno, and we flew down there in a private plane and one of these little tiny things, and got there. And I got my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. All of the women knew my sponsor, and they all come up and hug him, and nobody wanted to hug me. but that let me know that I was a part of something huge.
So working with that sponsor, did you guys go through the book line by line, or did he have, what was his style of going through the steps?
Well, we didn't go through the steps. He knew I was so crazy. He just stayed on, just stay sober today. Just today. Easy does it, stay sober today. And I was stuck on the first half of the first step for 5 years. I couldn't get past it. They would ask me questions like this. Well, Dick, how do you feel? And I tell them the truth with my hands. How else do you feel? I was so cold and so tough that it didn't, inside of me, I was so afraid. I thought if I turned my life over to something, I'd become the hole in the donut. I didn't understand the other stream of consciousness that was already in my head. I didn't, but I, when I knew when I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was safe. And then about nine months sober, my sponsor calls me up and says, we're going golfing. I said, what do you mean? I don't golf. He says, click, we're going. And he picked me up. And one of the fellas that was late to get up, that was going to be part of the foursome. And while I was getting ready, his daughter served and her son was with her, and she served me a cup of coffee. And she's still serving me a cup of coffee. And we'll be married 51 years in February. And my sponsor got real nervous because, man, met her in October. I proposed to her in November, and we were married in February. And he is getting real nervous. He says, Dick, you better tell her about Al-Anon because she's going to need it. And I said, why? Why would she need to go? She's never seen me drinking. She's never seen me drunk. He said, you just tell her. Well, I did. And she said, I don't need that. And I said, fine, don't go. That was 2 weeks before the wedding. 2 months after the wedding, she's saying, where are those meetings at? Because she was trying to please an alcoholic who hadn't finished the first step yet. And no, she made 9-course meals. She had to play spotless. She wanted to sit and talk. And she'd whisper in my ear, and I go, what the hell are you doing? And she finally realized that she needed those meetings. And I picked her up after the first meeting. I said, what'd you talk about? And she said, they told me you would say that. You work your program and I'll work mine. And they let her know, you know, he hasn't finished the first step yet. There's nothing you can do to make him happy. All you can do is focus on your son. And the only place that I felt safe for those first 4 or 5 years of meetings, and I went to meetings a lot because when I got in there, I was safe, not from other people, but I was safe from myself. And that's all I knew. And that's all I could do. And we got transferred to Hawaii during that time after I was sober. Well, real quick, about 9 months sober, I went to a meeting in Napa. And they said, are you in the Navy, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, there's an article in the grapevine about asking people that are in AA, the active duty in the Navy, to help with their program. The same program that Harry got involved in. And I responded to that, and I became a counselor, but I still couldn't see how my life was unmanageable sober. But I tried to help others. For some reason, I didn't understand, and now I do. Nobody asked me to be my sponsor in those 4 or 5 years. And then what was changed, the thing that saved my life, was I get home from work about 4:30 in the evening, and my wife would be at the neighbor's till 7. For 6 months, she wouldn't answer me when I'd say, well, how come you're always at the neighbor's? And finally she did. I says, I'll tell you why I'm at the neighbor's. The neighbors appreciate me as a person, and you don't. The neighbors enjoy my sense of humor. You're threatened by it. The neighbors allow me to have the last word sometimes. You never do. The neighbors allow me to have a bad day. And you say, how can you have a bad day when you're married to me? And then she got to the heavy stuff. She said, I thought you had learned to love me, but the only thing you love is yourself. And if I wasn't on this rock of Hawaii, I'd leave you because I'm not getting anything from you. And I had no smart remark from that one. And what I saw in my mind's eye was the second half of the first step. That my life was unmanageable, drunk or sober. And I asked myself this question. have I ever given this program a shot? And the answer was no. Well, what do I have to lose? And that's when I got into the steps. That's when I joined a step study meeting. That's when as my home group, a type of meeting I used to avoid like the plague. That's when my sponsor, I got a real sponsor, and he says, you need to get part of service. And I became a GSR. And within 6 months, the DCM came open and they asked me to do that. I was elected to that. In the last 2 years that I was in Hawaii, I had the pleasure of serving as the alternate area chairman for the state. And the reason was simply this. I read in the book on page 55, the chapter 3 agnostics, within each human being is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, or by worship of other things. And just for a second, when I didn't use those things, this sense of peace came over me, a sense that I now know was the thing that saved me from the spiritual malady of not feeling connected to anything or anybody. And when I felt that sense of peace, all of a sudden you people were no longer competition. All of a sudden I wasn't we were a part of instead of apart from. And I found to this day, I need to hook up with my higher powers, I understand it, but not using my mind for those things. And when I don't, this sense of peace allows me to do things that I can never do myself. And it's still a daily thing. But the reality was that allowed me to get involved and to be a part of AA. And the amazing thing, people started asking me to be their sponsor. And I saw that through working as a DCM and then as the alternate area chairman, the 12 concepts of world service. And these have become the concepts that I try to base things that I go on. And then there was one other thing that really affected me it took my wife 2 years to trust this change in me. And when she finally did, we fell in love and we had a son who was born premature, and he had birth defects from the beginning, we could see. And then on the third day of his life, we found the doctor let me know he had a 3-chambered heart. And he asked me a question no parent wants to hear, and that is, what should we do if he gets into difficulty? And I was so dumbfounded I couldn't answer him, but the still small voice in me, the same voice the night that I first felt this not using pomp, calamity, worship, and other things, said, do whatever it does to take him, to keep him alive. And that voice again reiterated to me what it said the first time, and that was, there's nothing wrong with you. You let me take care of you. You try to take care of others. And when I found out was going on, the pain was so great, I couldn't even get near the son in the special care nursery. And I knew I was in trouble, and I went out in the hallway and I prayed the 11-step prayer, asking only for the knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And what came back in meditation was something like this. He's still alive, and whose child is it anyway? And what makes you think you have a guarantee you're always going to be with the ones you love? And don't you know, because of the way you are, the only thing that's certain in your life is my love for you and your love for me. And with that, you can handle anything. Without that, you can't handle nothing. And with that, I could be with my son, and I could comfort my wife. And when I went to my home group, the next meeting, I don't know who was squeezing harder, the people that were squeezing my hand or me squeezing them. And that was my home group, was a Territorial Trust and Savings Big Book 12 and 12 meeting. And seven of us from that meeting back in the 70s are still in touch on Zoom. The group, I'm here because of the group and not just because of me. And I'm here also because I still know that my head is not the solution, it is the problem. And when I get out of my head and listen to the still small voice, that's when I can be of service. And after I retired from the Navy, I started to work for a private nonprofit in San Diego County. And I was coordinating an outpatient program because the other thing is when my son passed, I said, what do I want to do when I grow up? And I wanted to be of help, not only in the service, but also in the communities. And to do that, I went back and I finished my college. I flunked out when I was 19 because of my drinking. And I finally finished many years later. When I finished, I had instead of a 0.72, I had a 3.97 grade average. And I was able to be of service. And I was working at this clinic in Ramona. And my bosses called and said, we've been asked to bid on a women's prison program. Do you have any stuff for program? And I had some stuff. And then they says, if we write this up and they accept it, will you run the program? And I said, yes. And so it was my deep pleasure from 1991 to 1998 to coordinate a women's prison program at CIW between Chino and Corona. And working with those women brought back what a friend of mine 2 years after our son died. I was having a hard time. What possible good could come out of our son only living a week? And after about 2 years after that, he had said to me, Dick, why do you treat everybody as if they're precious? And then I knew that my son and God had given me a wonderful gift. And that's what I had to bring to those women, is I treated them as precious. And we had eight counselors. We stuck pretty much together for the 8 years. And those women could know that we were for real. And it felt good to be a real human being trying to share instead of always just thinking of me.
So how has AA changed, do you think, from your first exposure to now? Like, what's the biggest differences you see?
The way people come in, as it is so beautifully said by some other people, I did a lot of 12-step work myself, and now most of the people go through a program or they get medically detoxed. But the thing of it is that one thing hasn't changed, and that is the love and caring in the groups. There's several people here that I have had the pleasure of going to meetings with for over almost 29 years. Here, I moved here in 92, 93. And being a part of the group and part of the meetings to me has always been important. One of the biggest things that have changed is people talking more about the solution, talking about the steps. When I came in, we talked about the problem. We had drug logs you wouldn't believe, baby. I mean, we could really get in there and we could tell them what it was like when we were spitting and the sawdust was in our nose. But the reality is what we hear today at AA, but mostly what I hear is the solution. Talking about what happened to me after through the steps and through service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the other thing that has changed is the singleness of purpose. We still honor it, but the reality is this. Almost anybody coming under 40 is a chemical gourmet, has been talked about. And the reality is we focus on the alcohol, but we focus on being abstinent. And for me to be able to include people, at one time we talked about those druggies, to include people who want to have a different life, to me is the absolute thing. People used to be worried about, well, if you talk about anything other than alcohol, people are going to identify. Well, now on a one-to-one basis, if you don't talk about stuff other than alcohol, how in the hell are they going to identify? And for me, the reality is that this is a fellowship of the Spirit, and the Spirit is more important than the thing. But I have had some wonderful connections to the past. When I was first sober, the first year there up in Northern California, there was a guy that came to the club, and he was welcomed by another lady, had 13 years, and he had gotten sober in 1942, and he was introduced to me, and he says to me, listen, kid, we don't get here when we're young because we're lucky. We get here because we're young because we're desperate. And I've always remembered that. And I also had the pleasure at a general service or meeting, service meeting in San Francisco to shake the hand of Dewey, of one of the first 100. And for me, those things still give me goosebumps, is that we are part of a chain. We are part of a wonderful chain that has to be transmitted to newcomers in order to continue this chain. And so the fact of that, what I like about how AA has changed a lot is they haven't changed the big book, but every 20 years, but they sure changed those pamphlets. And they get used the pamphlets, and they use the grapevine as a way of keeping AA current. And I am so, so grateful for that. And
and Dick, you mentioned the grapevine. You had an article recently in the grapevine. And there's that part, which you already mentioned, I was going to ask you about it anyway, that on 55, about the thing blocking us from God, that calamity, pomp, worship of other things. And in that article, you kind of you expand on what those are. Can you do that? We're about 5 minutes left. You go over that real quick?
I will try. The first is calamity. When I see problems, my mind magnifies them into the thing of, my God, the world's going to end. It magnifies it. And it uses calamity to think, well, what's the use? And that kind of stuff. And so I have to let it know it's a day at a time. And this business of being pompous, I always thought that I was never equal to anybody. I was always better than people or worse than people, but never equal. So nobody could touch me. And I could protect what I thought I could be protected because I was different. And that was the very thing that was keeping me from being a part of. And so to this day, I still take an inventory on those things. And worship of other things, my intellect, my ability to manipulate, to get my identity from what I do instead of who I am. And to look at even the length of sobriety as something, as some badge. All it is a day at a time. And so for me, when I don't do those things, I can listen to the still small voice. I can do something that I look for in alcohol, and I found it on my first time I drank, and I chased it ever since, was a sense of peace. And when I get out of the way and I don't use those things, then I can take the inventory on my resentments, my fears, and my sex life. And I can see not only how I've been blocked from God, but because when I'm blocked from God, that's when the resentments, the fears, and the sex life comes. And I can see those things. And then I try to, every night, ask for, how can I be of service to you today, and to be a part of that reality that they talk about being rocketed into the fourth dimension. I still can't handle the third dimension. But the reality is, when I live in the peace in the fourth, I can allow my wife to ask questions before that where I resent it. Like, where are you going? How can I help you? What do you think? I need help? You know, my head. And I can be a part of. I can do something that I could never do before, and that is be an equal partner with another human being. And for me, that is so grateful. And that, for me, is a daily thing. See, when I go to sleep at night, I'm not conscious, and I lose my conscious contact with God, and my head can build a case in about 2 or 3 hours. And then I wake up in the morning, and I have to review and continue, how can I be of service today? And so I'm really appreciative of this opportunity to share with you this wonderful journey that I never even thought I would be on. And after the 91 or 98, when I was no longer with the Women's Prison Program, I got to work for another private nonprofit a school district, where I was able for 12 years to work in parole offices and jails and trying to help keep people out of prison instead of going back. And for me, those have been the things that have been a joy of my life. And to this day, my sponsor had 62 years, and he passed away in October. And I knew that it was coming. And so I had, thanks to Zoom, I got really hooked into a solutions-based meeting out of North Carolina. And I still go there every 5 o'clock in the morning. every day that I can. And I found a man there who's got 30 years of sobriety, but he's somebody that I can talk to and just talk. And then just if I can share my crazy head with him, and we can get back into a sense of peace if I start getting out of it. And so I treasure the fact that this is a we program and not an I program.
Well, thank you, Dick. I appreciate you sharing, some of your history, and it's been good knowing you. And thank you for allowing me to give this interview.
Thank you very much.